Good day, everybody. Good day. This is James McCanny. You're expecting Daniel Brigman, probably, but I'm filling in for Daniel today, the full show, and a lot of topics to cover today. I'm going to have as my guest Charles Ortel, and I'm sure most of you are familiar with his work. And the last time, I've been a guest host on the Power Hour many times, but about 2 years, 2.5 years ago, it was February 24th, 2018, I had Charles Ortel also as my guest. And at that time, we were talking about Charles was on his way to Germany to investigate corruption within the German government regarding the Clinton Foundation, where they were accepting bribes from General Electric and Siemens to place three-blade wind turbines, not only in Germany, but in many foreign countries. But the spearheading of the investigation was going on in Germany because Siemens is a German company. So I'll be asking Charles about that. And also, Charles co-hosts a radio show every Sunday. It's called Crowdsource the Truth, and that's with Jason Goodman. So he's a co-host, and they also co-host another show airing today. It's called Closing In. And so anyway, Charles, are you there? Have we gotten you back now? Oh, okay. We're having an issue with Charles' connection there. So at any rate, I'll take this moment to just mention to listeners, excuse me, I'm having a little voice issue here today also. But for a long time, as you probably know, listeners, I have my water filter product line, and we have been out of stainless steel containers. Well, we have a replacement in place. They're terracotta stoneware filter containers. So those are now available. And so a little bit of promotion there at the website, jmccsci.com. And okay, Charles, do we have you now? There we go. I got that clicking sound fixed. That's much better. So, Charles, I did a little bit of an intro. I talked about the co-host, you and Jason Goodman, Crowdsourcing the Truth, and also Closing In, which airs later today. And also, I mentioned about the last time that I had an interview with you on the Power Hour was 2.5 years ago. It was February 24th, 2018. And you were on your way to Germany to deal with the German government and issues with Siemens and General Electric, some kickback schemes, apparently, that were going on there.
Foundation. I have in the past done work on General Electric. Starting in 2007, I exposed what I considered to be a massive fraud. And that was when the stock price was up at 40, and today it's more like 7. So, and the market's gone up a heck of a lot since July 2007. So that was my focus. I'm somewhat familiar with Siemens as well. I think they're in many of the same businesses, and I, you know, when I punch in the name of a prospective company or person about which I'm worried about fraud, I would just punch in Siemens and fraud or GE and fraud and into Google, and you'll be amazed the number of hits that you get and the number of stories around the world, the number of times both companies, and in particular Siemens, has been disciplined for fraud many, many places.
Right, right. Right now, General Electric is being investigated for mismanagement, and I believe there are criminal level charges for the management. One thing that I'm trying to follow is how they have ruined the three-blade wind industry. They are, for example, all of the international organizations like American Wind Energy Association, the Canadian Wind Energy Association. The first person on the board of these organizations is General Electric. And so they have basically fixed the wind in the, excuse me, industry where they, excuse me, they are getting subsidies, but basically marketing a product that does not work. And the end result is that it pushes the industry back to GE's main core business, which is the Central Power Company and nuclear.
Well, so the problem that I saw, I became interested in GE back in 2006-07 timeframe, and it was at a time when I had spent 5 years actually away from working and taking care of my young kids then, and I was thinking about going back into private equity or industry or whatever. So I decided to study 25 large publicly traded companies, American companies, to just get a sense of were they fairly valued or not. And in one of them I obviously picked was GE, because for much of my adult career, got out of business school in 1980, GE was held up as the example of the preeminent type of conglomerate. Indeed, the dean of Harvard Business School, where I went, was on the board of GE. And so we had a lot of cases about GE, and it was supposed to be a great company. And I had some personal experience actually working at a high level within GE on some projects, and I was not impressed. So initially, it was so complicated that I decided that I better just put the whole thing to this. Hello?
Hello. Yeah, you're here, Charles. You're doing good.
I just heard of something. Anyway, so I decided to put the case on the side when I looked at the other 24 companies. And then I, being stubborn, said, well, I better figure this GE out. And what the short version of thousands of pages of research is that the GE was covered as if it were an industrial and services conglomerate by analysts who understood different product lines and pieces of GE, but who were never presented the cash flow information, the robust granular cash flow and balance sheet income statement information that you can get on most competitors of GE. So they missed the obvious problem, which was under Welch, and starting in about 89, GE got into the finance business in a big way, fooling people, maintaining a AAA rating when they didn't deserve the highest possible credit rating. Very few companies today have that rating. And trying to compete with people who are far less experienced and not paid as well as the sharks on Wall, that are not really even inside the banks, but the very rich investors who are much faster than GE will ever be. And what happened is that over time, GE did deal after bad deal and piled on massive debt. And so I was able to look at it in a slightly different way than others did. And I called it out on Bloomberg TV in January 16th, 2008, the day that the U.S. government seized AIG, the day that Lehman failed over the weekend. I went on Bloomberg, which has a big audience, on their 5 o'clock show then called Taking Stock. I said, if you think you have problems with AIG, they're nothing compared to the problems that you're going to have with GE. And therein was quite controversial, and I got a lot of coverage for pointing that out and really being the first, following Bill Gross, who in 2002, I think, made similar sorts of comments but didn't take it quite as far as I did. GE has really never been the same, and it deserves. It's a case study for me. If GE couldn't make it, with all the advantages that it had and that America has against other countries, there must be something wrong with the system. And that's when I began to cotton on to the fact that this idea of unregulated globalism, where no country is robust enough or interested enough to protect the interests of its citizens, is a very bad idea that serves the deep state swamp around the world. It serves the universities. It serves the established media companies, investment firms, but it does not serve the middle class, the working class, the people who play by the rules. And I think it explains the adherence and interest in this unregulated globalism lies at the heart of the 2020 campaign and the 2016 campaign. The people who love unregulated globalism are the ones who profit corruptly from it, be they the Biden family, the Clinton family, the Obama family, the Bush family, you name it. The people... Right. Who you know, get up every morning and worry about putting food on the table for themselves and their families, saving for their retirement, and play by the rules because they know right from wrong. You know, those are the people who are fighting against the swamp and who should rise up and insist that the leadership at GE and other companies who have profited, I would argue, shamelessly. I mean, you can't go after Welch now because he's dead, but the people who who profited from the exploitation of unregulated globalism and not playing by the rules and didn't have to pay for the financial bailout yet in 2009, those people need to be held to account.
Well, the other thing with GE is they had a lot of military work, a lot of secret military work, like building nuclear submarines, you know, not exactly a minor ticket item. And
they got out of that. Of course, they got out of that long ago. They got out of the defense business long ago.
So, but they wouldn't they benefit from a lot of government contracts and doing, say, Boeing gets a contract for a jet. I mean, GE's going to get a piece of that somewhere, and other companies, I would think.
Yeah, everyone says that GE is diversified, and I actually think that GE is not diversified. If you take away the finance piece, which is being almost wound down now, really the closest correlation post, say, 1999 or 2002 or thereabouts in GE's performance is with oil price. When oil price is high, people who have big infrastructure projects have the money to pay for them. People who operate transportation systems want to replace their engines or their planes or their railroad stock or their cars, and GE thrives. When oil price is low, those projects make no sense. You know, the whole renewables area makes zero sense at $40 oil. So GE and its annual sales projects doesn't do well. And in addition to that, because they've engineered all these crazy joint ventures and international schemes around the world, they have, I think, gigantic unstated liabilities, which will only be seen once lawyers go through all of the contracts and all of the schedules and all of their fast deals. GE had a history of paying top dollar for its acquisitions, but selling out when they got out of business is not at good prices. And oftentimes to maximize the sale proceeds in a divestiture, they would take liabilities on that the buyer didn't want and hope that these would be buried. So I think it's a good case study, General Electric, to educate the leaders of tomorrow, and it needs to be told in great depth. I hope it will be.
Yeah, the thing that personally aggravates me is how they've destroyed the wind energy industry. And my analysis is they planned this literally over a decade ago, how they would come in, introduce this product that literally didn't work when everybody figured it out and all the government subsidies had been paid. And now they are promoting the demise of that industry, stating that, oh, doggone, we got to get back to that really good central power company, stable power, and eventually move to nuclear, which GE wants to move into in the United States. And so they've destroyed what you would call alternative energy to push the industry back to their core business, which is the central power company. For example, they have one of their big generators. It's a natural gas generator, looks like a jet engine. It's a two-cycle electrical generation, now very popular in central power companies. They have more of those installed in the world at who knows how many tens, millions of dollars each. They have more of those installed in the world than they do wind turbines. So that gives you an idea of the scale of their central power commitment.
Yeah, again, I didn't delve too much into the individual business lines of GE. What I instead figured out is the how to value the finance business. It's actually very simple to value a bank or finance business. You value them in relation to what's called their tangible book value. And that is the net worth of the company, less any goodwill and intangibles. And most banks actually today are trading at a tight multiple, 1.25 times tangible book. And if you assessed a fair multiple on GE Capital back in 2007 when I did, you could come up with, you subtract the value, the fair value from the total market value of the company, and then you look at that residual, which is everything else, and ask, is that fairly valued? And I found that it was overvalued by a massive amount, because I was able to subtract the entire results of take the total results and subtract finance business from the total and derive the financial statements that GE never publishes. And so that's the way I didn't go to the level of saying, well, the power business is good or this business is bad. And it, with certain exceptions. But I take your point. Wind energy will always be a tiny percentage, I think, of total energy consumed around the world. My view.
Well, if I have anything to do with it, it'll become dominant. My invention, the wing generator, is a system that does work. But I wanted to get back to your statement about the Clintons and the Bushes and the, you know, the globalism. I think that's where the audience is really has some interest because the election is going on right now. This is a huge election issue. And not only are you voting for candidates, you're voting whether you want globalism or, you know, basically an economy that's run by mom and pops, you know, stores down the street and not by Amazon, you know, being the only retail market on the planet. But also the globalists, the Clintons and the Bushes, who I see as the visible people in representing a lot of invisible people that we never see.
Yeah, so a great source of information for your audience are actually statistics that are produced by an arch globalist operation, UNCTAD, UNCTAD, has a very good data center. It's free. And what they've gone and done is they have not only prepared information going all the way back to 1970 on every country in the world translated to dollars, but they've done us a service by dissecting the economies and showing you for every economy where there's information, that's most of them, they show you the consumption slice of the economy, they show you the capital investment slice. And in my view, those are the two important pieces of an economy. I think the gross domestic product is a deeply flawed statistic with many false assumptions in it that overcompensates, double counts government wages, for example, as being productive in the economy. It assumes that any money spent by the government will actually not cost you money, that it'll provide a zero return, which is absurd. And there are other problems that even the founder of the original concept, Simon Kuznets, who won the Nobel Prize in Economics in the 30s, even he in his submission to Congress, the Senate Finance Committee in the 30s explaining this, cites these many problems. So you look at consumption, you look at capital investment. Capital investment is not buying in the stock market. That's when people judge your wind project or GE's and they fight about it and they say, I'll do this project versus that project in boardrooms and desks and bank offices around this country. People tend in the private sector to fight over, not literally physically, but to debate strenuously whether it makes sense to invest money and typically to try to seek a return of capital on that. When you look at this information, they provide it for the whole world total, and they provide it country by country. What you see, and it should be obvious, is that really top 20, top 40 countries, so 10 to 20% of the nations on Earth account for 80 to 90% of all economic activity. So if you set up a structure that involves the other, let's call it 160 nations, say they're 200, you are getting into a needlessly complex mess that you shouldn't waste much time on. It makes a lot more sense from an economic standpoint. Now, I'm not talking politics or social issues, but just from a pure business standpoint, you would focus on the 20 to 40 countries on Earth, and you would hope that those countries were well-run themselves, rather than investing a lot of time and attention in a system which has no army, no tax system, no ability to enforce anything, but instead provides cover for bureaucrats to concoct these crazy schemes that nobody really tests, where people around the world say, oh my goodness, you know, let's support the victims of this natural disaster, or let's fight against this unseen peril of 20 years, or this or that. And gigantic pots of streams of money go into pots, typically in Switzerland or offshore, where national leaders and former national leaders run around in private jets claiming that they're actually doing stuff for the benefit, but nobody actually checks. a favorite case in point for me is the situation with the World Health Organization. It is run by a diabolically bad criminal who came out of Ethiopia, who is not a medical doctor, who was a disaster in Ethiopia. And there are today more doctors of Ethiopian descent in Chicago, Illinois, than there are in Ethiopia. Ethiopia has more than approximately 100 million people in it. I think it's around 100 million, 70% of whom live without access to electricity. They have no roads to speak of. It's a vast country. They have little clean water. The sanitation situation is horrible. Naturally, very few hospitals exist, so there are very few doctors or nurses there, so the health situation is atrocious. It's a big geographic territory with few roads, few paved roads, and that's a big problem if you have, you know, washouts and this and that. Unlike the U.S. and Europe and Japan, people are not concentrated in the big cities. They're scattered to the wind. And this crazy person, Tedros, Dr. Tedros, gets put in charge of the World Health Organization, and we see what a poor job he has done with that. So, in contrast to this blind, when you take a whole bunch of impressionable school kids or college kids together and you say, you know, what are you in favor of, nationalism or globalism? Of course, all the kids say globalism. And the professors say it too. I mean, rather than being stuck in New Haven, Connecticut at Yale or pick a place, suddenly as a professor, you can fly around the world to your heart's content and poke your nose in other people's business, and nobody's ever going to check and see whether your idea actually worked.
Charles, we got some music coming on here. We'll revisit this at the end of the break. We've got a bottom of the hour break coming up about 6 minutes.
The Power Hour has been in existence since the turn of the 21st century. It is more critical than ever for you to sign up for our free newsletter and our breaking news. Simply text the word Power Hour to 22828 on your mobile phone, or sign up when you visit thepowerhour.com. Our website again is thepowerhour.com, or text Power Hour to 22828. Together, our legacy will live on for centuries.
What in the world is this crazy Willard water?
It's a proprietary solution, and it's a water additive that was invented by my grandfather, Dr. John Willard, and hence the name Willard Water. Boosts a number of different things. We see most prominently that it's increasing the absorption, utilization, and storage of nutrients in the cells. So, for example, if people were drinking, we see a big boost in B vitamin absorption utilization. If you see it in plants, we see a big boost in their ability to absorb and retain fertilizers or nutrients in the soils. I think we see with things like microbes. If you used a microbe on soil, for example, to replenish the soil, and you sprayed our Willard water on it, go through that replenishing cycle much faster.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at theparamall.com. That's theparamall.com.
Break the bond of Big Pharma. Hi, it's Joyce Riley with the Power Hour to tell you about the powerful benefits of Strauss Heart Drops. Many people today are locked into the routine of taking multiple prescription drugs. Strauss Herb Company believes that everything the body needs is provided by nature. Strauss Heart Drops may clear congested arteries, restore damaged muscle, maintain healthy cholesterol levels, and flush toxins and metals from the body. They may even be helpful in treating varicose veins. And unlike prescription drugs that are packed with chemicals, Strauss Heart Drops are 100% natural and harness the healing power of herbs like garlic, cayenne, white willow bark, and mistletoe. For the full line of Strauss products, I urge you to call the Power Hour at 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or visit thepowermall.com. And remember, beware of knockoffs. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
If you eat Numana food on a semi-regular basis, you're probably getting better quality food and healthier for your body than you're eating now.
Your products are GMO-free. There's no added MSG and no chemical preservatives or high fructose corn syrup. And you also have gluten-free products as well.
We have a great variety of very high-quality products.
Call 1-877-817-9829 right now and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com.
Boost your immune system naturally this year with Olive Oregano, a potent germ killer. This is the true wild oregano oil P73, a blend of edible spices of wild oregano grown on natural mineral-rich soils. Research published in the International Journal of Food Microbiology found that Olive Oregano is an excellent germicide capable of killing a wide range of fungi and bacteria. Get it today by visiting thepowermall.com or calling 877-817-9829.
And welcome back. Welcome back. This is James McCanney sitting in for Daniel Brigman. Today it's the 14th of October. And my guest today, Charles Artel. We've been talking about General Electric, but we're going to change the direction a little bit here and talk about some of the corruption going on in that Charles has been investigating. But Charles, we were talking offline about COVID-19 and your belief that this will accelerate the job income growth in the West as one of the unplanned side effects.
Yeah, I think what's going to happen here, and it's long overdue, is that larger companies are going to look and have been looking at the complex messes that consultants and professors and others, other, quote, thought leaders have foisted upon us, and are going to start asking the very simple question, why, if the American market is so large and promising, and if Europe, the EU is disintegrating, and if China has its difficulties, why do we have so many people spread all over the world, in theory, attacking opportunities that may or may not yield dividends and returns of capital to home, when we can instead either chop off these foreign pieces or return to the days where companies exported, American companies exported from America and employed suppliers closer to home, in a much simpler structure. So instead of having these sector heads and geographic heads and many foreign subsidiaries that aren't making money, we simplify our business. And particularly in areas that are of great national security importance, for example, with COVID, we find all of a sudden something that many of us have been warning about for a long time, that our pharmaceutical industry is hostage to Indian and Chinese bankers of the active pharmaceutical ingredient, the so-called API portion of a drug. Very large percentages of our drugs are the API comes from these two countries, and that is not smart. As we saw at the beginning of COVID, China attempted to restrict, it is alleged, certain products from in advance of a wider realization of how serious this crisis is. So I think we're going to see many industries returning much faster into the U.S., and that's going to help employment prospects, particularly for people coming out of these badly damaged colleges and universities. And it's going to be very good for America. It's going to be very bad for China. And it, depending on how India decides to play, it may be either good or bad for India. So this period here of introspection is going to change the way that many people think about and carry on with their lives. And it may have many positive benefits. One, I hope, will be that people will stop taking the easy way out and asking an expert to tell them what to do, and instead we'll use that large piece of equipment that sits on our shoulders, specifically your brain, to think for yourself. And, you know, we've been living here at the behest of experts who've been proven wrong. Nobody is yet standing up and saying, wait a minute, we've had 7 months damage to the largest economy, the global economy. Who's going to pay for all this? You know, we followed experts blindly, and they were wrong. This should cause us to think deeply about not only the medical profession, but the educational profession, and the wisdom of subjecting yourself to an expertology, which is what, you know, of course, all the pundits want you to do.
Right, exactly. You mentioned education. It's one of my topics I deal with all the time, is that the educational systems have been taken over, and you were mentioning this off there too, also when we were talking. It's been literally taken over by people who have gotten their degree, they went on to advanced degrees, they got their PhD, and then they went directly into teaching in a university. They've never had a business, they don't know what a bottom line is, they don't know what a balance sheet is, and they talk about the liberal globalism as if they were experts, and that's what they're teaching in the universities today. And that's why we have kids running up and down the street burning things down with no employment, getting paid by George Soros. That's their job.
Right. Yeah, I mean, when I was graduated from Yale in 1978 and Harvard Business School in 1980, and back then, the teachers were tolerant. They encouraged debates. They encouraged different ideas to come to the fore. There were, of course, the hard left Marxists still, you know, there, but in the main, the universities were places where you were encouraged to push the frontiers of knowledge and to debate respectfully people of opposing views. Back then, while it was expensive to go to these places, relative to the starting salary you could get, whether out of Yale or Harvard or college or business school, the annual cost was a tiny fraction of how much money you might make after tax in your very early years, so it made a lot of sense. In addition, teachers at these places actually taught the students. They weren't preoccupied in getting involved in some big investment scheme with an alumnus or getting paid consulting fees, numerous consulting fees. They actually taught and interacted with students. Moreover, the campuses were principally devoted to domestic U.S. citizens. And I look at the educational system from the perspective of somebody who's focused on charity fraud in the Clinton Foundation. We can get to that in a second. But when you think about education, these universities receive exemption from taxes, not to become gigantic hedge funds and private equity operations through their endowments, but because society back in England felt that these places ought to be subsidized because we're educating future generations, that people were sacrificing to talk there. Not so today. You look at these big institutions, you have university presidents making in the millions of dollars and getting bonuses and living like kings in the mansions that the schools give them. Of course, at the brand name places, you have, you know, so much demand from around the world for the scarce number of physical places at a Yale, Harvard, et cetera. So they can fill up these classes very easily. They don't have an issue at all. And you look at particularly the professional schools, say the business school or law schools or medical schools, why should these be subsidized? I understand subsidizing people studying Latin and Greek and English and the humanities, that I get. But if you're going out there to get a professional credential, and if a place like Harvard Business School or Law School or Yale or whatever mints money in these businesses, why but I mean, in these operations, why should the U.S. taxpayer subsidize them? And then, because these brand name universities, the faculty have tenure, and they have untold amount of money, they don't listen to the alumni. They don't care what the alumni think, the older alumni think. And they're ungovernable. Nobody, you know, nobody can tell them that what they're doing makes no sense. And so I've noticed here in New York, I moved back here to the city in 2007, the prevalence of what I call scruffies. Young kids, young boys, typically men, with scruffy beards and silly clothing, wearing stupid wool hats in the summer and carrying these backpacks on skateboards and spouting rubbish as fact, and failing to appreciate that America really is a great place. You've traveled, as I have, to more than 70 countries around the world. There's no large country in the world that offers a rising generation to start with nothing at age 18 and become a billionaire before the age of 40. There's no large nation that allows somebody from a modest background to propel him or herself forward, particularly if they're from a minority, a swath of that population, other than this country. And instead of bemoaning our present situation, there should be some balance. That's something that universities used to provide, and they don't. And shame on them. And they price themselves out of the market.
Oh, exactly. And when they talk about diversity, you go to any college university webpage on the front, you know, the biggest thing they advertise is diversity. So they have a Chinese kid, a black kid, a white kid, you know, and they have a token member from each one. And this is skin deep diversity, I call it that. But you go into the classroom, there's no diversity. It's socialism. It's, you know, in you were talking about tenure. To get tenure, you know, you have to do so many things. You have to get so many grants if you're in the sciences and bring in a certain amount of money, have so many published papers. But the key to being in tenure also, the hidden thing, is being on that social agenda, the Communist Manifesto agenda, to teach in the classroom. It's unspoken, but it's there, and it's crept in since the time that you and I were in college and university level. It's very much there. So I say it's skin-deep diversity is what they present. It's not real diversity. It's not diversity of thought.
I couldn't agree more. I mean, I back in the late 60s and early 70s, when the current generation of people who believes they are in charge of the world were young, they would say, don't trust anybody over 30. And they would demand that people, the orthodox, you know, leaders of the country back then, consider their radical thinking, at least give it some thought, you know, be tolerant of these new views. Today, these universities have become intolerant, and I would argue they are not charities. The rule, if we look into, as I have now for 5 years, gone through a big case study, the rules that govern the way universities should run provide that the university may not engage, the charity may not engage in partisan political activity of any kind, whether supporting or opposing a candidate or a platform. You're not supposed to do that. In addition, you're not, through the operation of the charity, supposed to create what is called private gain. And it's a term broader than financial gain. It's financial gain, and as well as advantages, edges, et cetera, provided through the operation of the charity. And there have been charities shut down that cumulatively over their life created financial gain of only less than $1,000. So through that prism, if you look at some of these places, these aren't charities. These are businesses. And they've been corrupted and co-opted. And this needs to change. They have, as you say, if you want to promote an idea and suddenly you get a Harvard professor or a Yale professor, a Cornell professor to write a paper in a peer reviewed journal that advocates your point of view or your product or whatever, that's enormously valuable. That is not what we should be doing in these universities. Instead, we need, as I say, to be advancing the frontiers of knowledge. Universities reject the past. How stupid is that? because, you know, here we are living in the present. Do we want 10 years from now, 20, 30 years from now, people to reject our experience as being meaningless? Of course you learn from the past. And that's what these people should be doing in university. They should be focusing on reacquainting themselves and the students with the greatest minds that have ever lived. Instead of, you know, I read recently some university or another has proposed the idea that math is racist, that 1 + 1 doesn't necessarily equal 2. I mean, come on.
Yeah, how much more crazy can it get? That's the one end of the spectrum. I did a show recently on the Nobel Prizes, and the recent one in physics and chemistry just given out. The first thing is that it's very much involved in identity politics, but this goes back to the issue of tenure. And the idea in the sciences, like, say, the last number of Nobel Prizes have been dealing with the Big Bang, which I don't think there's any proof at all, or something called dark matter, which they can't even define. But they're giving Nobel Prizes in this, but they're all going to these university professors at Berkeley or UCLA were two of them. And then you have some, a big one of the German universities. But there's got to be a lot of politics behind the scene to get your university into the Nobel, you know, nominations and then winning it. Of course, that brings in a lot of money and eventual notoriety to have that person sitting on your staff. But it also blocks out anything else, just exactly like what you're saying. It kind of like it drives a nail in the coffin of any other alternative explanations of anything. And this could be in your field, like economics, or it could be in sciences, physics, chemistry. You know, there again, it's so politicized when you get up to that level, or Obama getting a Nobel Peace Prize 2 months into his tenure as president. You know, totally political.
Yeah. It wasn't 2 months. I think it was several days. But, I mean, perhaps we should drift into the talking about a little bit about the Clinton Foundation, because I think that's one of the main traffickers in this unregulated globalism. And
right.
If you agree, maybe I can bring you up to date on where we are.
Yeah,
in that.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Yeah, this is, I'm sorry, we're kind of skirting around these other topics. But yeah, just feel free to jump in where you want and bring us up to date on all the work you're doing and where things are in terms of, the Clinton Foundation investigations. And there's been some absolutely amazing recent announcements also.
Sure. So the situation is quite interesting for people. I bet you everybody on this who's listening to this in some way or another is acquainted with charities. If you're on the board of one or a manager of one, you tend to follow the rules carefully. That's a zone. It's a large piece of the American economy. Some think as much as 15% of our total activity is involved in not-for-profit. And under the terms of the law, not-for-profits, as I mentioned with regard to universities, are not supposed to engage in profit-making activities, substantial profit-making activities, or activities that are more than insubstantial, I should say. They're not supposed to be in politics. And most importantly, they actually have to exist. And in the case of, that's a technical thing. In the case of a not-for-profit corporation, I'm not a lawyer or an accountant, but I'm familiar with the rules now. It has to be not only incorporated, but it has to be organized. And that means you have to have articles of incorporation. Typically, you have to have bylaws. You have to have trustees who are independent, i.e. they will protect the interests of the charity against their own interests. They will discharge their duties of loyalty to the charity, of obedience to the law, and care. That is to say, they'll take the time required to do their job. And the Clinton Foundation has never done that. And the amazing thing of this, when I first started in on this, I wasn't as attuned to the law. I was more focused on the obvious mistakes in their financial filings, which are all wrong. I mean, grievously wrong. And then I discovered that the actual foundation was under FBI investigation for 4 years. 2001 to 2005, and that the people leading that investigation, the Justice Department person leading it was Jim Comey. The head of the FBI who was personally briefed was Bob Mueller. And the person in the Justice Department responsible for deciding which frauds got prosecuted was Rod Rosenstein. They spent 4 years on this and couldn't see the obvious fraud. So you carry that forward after they gave the Clinton Foundation a pass in 2005 under Bush, W. Bush, the frauds escalated. And this is a very, in theory, it should be a very simple charity. It was only authorized to store all of the presidential records created or received during Bill's 2 terms and to offer scholars a chance to consider these records at a research facility to be located adjacent to the archive. That's the only authority this thing has to operate. And to do that, it has to at all times be what's called a public charity. Now, a public charity is different than a private foundation. A public charity must stand in the shoes of government, can't be controlled by a family, certainly can't get involved in politics, certainly shouldn't have a penthouse apartment on the top of it, 5,000 square foot, with an outdoor gigantic patio that's to be exclusively used by the Clinton family. That's strictly forbidden. So the question here is why, you know, with all the rattling that Peter Schweizer started doing and I started doing in 2015, why has nothing happened here? What is taking so long? And I think what we will soon grow to realize is that, in particular, the Clinton Global Initiative, which is definitely not a charity and never was a charity, it was a conference for grifters in New York City where attendance was limited by the Clinton interests to people who wanted to pursue projects they said were charitable, but very often had a for-profit motive. And this is something that began November 16th, 2004 is the first evidence of, something that they got the website, Clinton Global Initiative, 2 days before the archive opened in Little Rock. And that, website was obtained, by a New York based operation that had not registered in New York State. Now, New York rules and laws are very strict on charities. But they're not enforced properly. They go after a Trump, but they let the Clintons, the Obamas, and others connected to the globalists get a pass. And this is costing New York State and city tremendous amounts of lost tax revenue. It is not good for the integrity of the judicial system, whether in the state or federally. It's not good for our national standing. And so I and others have been pushing hard that the Clinton Foundation needs to be put into conservatorship, meaning the trustees can't handle this, the Clintons need to be out of it, and we need to go back over the history to understand what crimes were committed, who needs to be held responsible, and how.
Well, Charles, from what I understood, that before the 2016 election, there was a war chest in the Clinton Foundation. And it was foreign countries. It was individuals looking for favors after Hillary was elected, and that there were people after the election, after she lost, that actually asked for their money back because they weren't going to get their political favors.
Yeah. So the Clinton. What's very interesting for people who are not yet familiar with foundations and charities is that the reports that circulate in the public domain are far better and more interesting for a charity than you can get on any company. Charities are required, particularly ones like the Clinton Foundation that operate in many states and internationally, are required to fill forms out that go into great depth. Their revenues by type, their big donors by amount, their expenses by category, their balance sheets, their cash flow statements, they need audits, and then there's a lot of textual information as well. And what you can do, and what I've done since getting into this, and I wrote a piece in Breitbart March 16th, 2015, with so many red flags, why isn't the IRS auditing the Clinton Foundation? That thing got an enormous amount of attention. And ever since then, there have been FBI investigations into the Clinton Foundation, and there now is we're learning, New York Times claims, Clinton Foundation confirms, there's an impaneled grand jury looking at the Clinton Foundation, which has been subpoenaed and is providing information. And they face a November 16th, 2020 IRS deadline where they have to fill their filings in for 2019 under penalties of perjury again, submitting them either by the mail, and if they do that falsely, that's a set of crimes, or electronically, if they do that falsely, another set of crimes. And I don't think they can do it. I don't think they can actually comply with the law. So they, whether something happens before the election or after the election, the set of charities, and it's not simply the Clinton charity alone. It's, they have a network of affiliates, the donors like the Gates Foundation who have given large amounts of money to a fraud and claimed in their filings that they gave it to a public charity when the Clinton Foundation is not a public charity, in my view. There's going to be a comeuppance against thousands of donors here. And actually, if the full story is eventually told here, this could well be a cautionary tale that could lead to the U.S. Treasury getting lots of money.
I hear the music coming here. It caught me by surprise, Charles. We'll be back in a couple minutes, top of the hour break. This is James McCann sitting in for Daniel Brigland on the Power Hour.
We've all heard about antibiotics, but what about probiotics? Antibiotic means against life. Probiotic means pro-life. Antibiotics kill bacteria that are infectious and harmful to the body. They also kill the good bacteria, though, that are necessary for good health. Probiotics from Living Streams replaces the healthy balance of friendly bacteria and normalizes the digestive tract. Gastritis, ulcers, diarrheal disease is just a few of the problems people develop when the intestinal flora is out of balance. Living Streams probiotics create the healthy balance needed for good digestion, suppresses growth of pathogenic bacteria, and actually increases resistance to infection. Call the Power Hour, 877-817-9829. Order your Living Stream probiotics today. They're available in 2, 4, and 8-ounce bottles, and Living Streams probiotics comes with a money-back guarantee. Get your body back in balance with Living Streams probiotics today. 877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Living Streams Probiotics. Everyone should be pro-life.
As you all know, everything begins with an idea. Ideas have helped shape the very world we live in. ThePowerMall.com began as an idea, allowing entrepreneurs and small business owners like yourself the opportunity to not only survive, but thrive in an era where corporations dominate. ThePowerMall.com is a small family-owned business who has partnered with companies you've come to rely on and trust over the years, like Strauss Heart Drops, North American Urban Spice, Miracle 2 Soaps, Vitamir, Numana Food Storage, to name just a few. Fight back against large corporations when you buy from thepowermall.com. Need to speak to a real person? Call Jay at thepowermall.com and receive superior customer service. Call 1-877-817-9829 right now. That number again is 1-877-817-9829. Support small businesses and buy from the good guys at thepowermall.com. That's thepowermall.com. Does Big Pharma have a hold of you? ThePowerMall.com believes everything the body needs is provided by nature, unlike prescription drugs that aren't meant to cure but cover up your symptoms and contain addicting chemicals. Strauss Heart Drops are 100% all natural. Get the original. Get Strauss Heart Drops by calling Jay at 1-877-817-9829. That's 877-817-9829. Or order online at ThePowerMall.com today.